So, good evening, everyone. Tonight, I'm going to talk about the 16 Bodhisattva precepts which we recited together in our sutra service. I recently shared a blog post introducing the precepts, so some of this might feel familiar. But I plan to look a little deeper into some complexities tonight. If all goes according to my plan, this should muddy the waters pretty well. What I'm really doing is acknowledging that for those of us who are committed to living according to the precepts, sometimes it isn't so easy. If it is, there's a good chance we're missing something. The 16 Bodhisattva precepts are ethical vows. We try, and if we're honest, frequently fail to uphold. As formulated by Ehe Dogen, they include the three refuges, the three pure precepts, and the 10 grave precepts. We sometimes discuss three approaches to the precepts. We could take them literally as statements telling us what we should and should not do. We can also view them compassionately and recognize that we all make mistakes. And we can receive them non-dualistically, opening us beyond certainty to the boundless field of no knowing. Approached in this balanced way, we can avoid becoming too fundamentalist with them, and the precepts simply offer moral guidance that we hold with compassion and humility. Moral guidance that we hold with compassion and humility. In our list of 16 precepts, the three refuges are the first three. We take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. To take refuge means to find shelter. In a literal sense, we can take refuge in the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, which serves as an inspiration to us in our practice. From the compassionate view, we might take refuge in ourselves as Buddhas. We come to see that our very lives are the life of Buddha, including our sadness and confusion and joy. And from the non-dualistic perspective, we're invited to take refuge in realization. From this perspective, there is no old age and death, and also no ending of old age and death. No suffering, no cause of suffering. We are already free, and there is nothing to attain. These three perspectives on the precepts may seem separate, but they are all ways of practicing awakening. Second, we take refuge in the Dharma, or literally, the Buddhist teachings. We can also translate Dharma as phenomena, things exactly as they are. And I can't help but think of the Muppet video, Phenomena. Anyway, from the perspective of compassion, we take refuge in the intimate caw of a crow. We take refuge in our own broken hearts. We take refuge in laughing children and ants and sticks and grizzly bears. Third, we take refuge in Sangha, or literally, our Zen practice groups. And what a joy it is to come and sit, walk, chant, bow together. Somehow, almost magically, in a way that I still don't understand. When we practice with others, our awareness is magnified and our own meditation deepens. Like mirrors, we seem to reflect and hold one another in our practices, and this is deeply nourishing. We can feel held in Sangha. One Sangha member recently described sitting together like floating in a warm water, like a warm sea. And we entrust the ice cubes of our broken hearts to this larger body where they slowly melt away. Waking up is not always easy. It's countercultural in a rather materialistic, goal-oriented society, and life is sometimes hard. We all can use a little help. One definition of refuge is assistance in distress. Taking refuge in Sangha means giving ourselves a safe haven to be vulnerable rather than needing to protect and defend ourselves all the time, rather than habitually trying to avoid our pain. After all, that which we run from controls us. In Sangha, we see that our hurts can be held by something bigger. As Thich Nhat Hanh said, when we add a tablespoon of salt to a small glass of water, the whole glass tastes bad. When we add a tablespoon of salt to a river, the water still tastes pure. In joining a Sangha, we are no longer alone. In our practice, we all support each other by showing up and holding one another in our hearts. Taking refuge in Sangha is also taking joy in each other's joy. In discussions, sometimes our laughter rings through the Dharma hall. Sometimes we play games at potluck lunches. From the broader compassionate view, our Sangha includes the entire world. Like Avalokiteshvara, we hear the cries of the world and respond with 1,000 hands, well, maybe 2. The world is very much with us, and we are very much with the world. We might notice the way the earth supports us when we sit, the way the air enters us when we breathe. We might notice the way our life is sustained by all beings, moment after moment, and thus the world is our refuge. From the perspective of non-duality, there is no separate world at all. There is no self, no other. What language can possibly describe the way all beings reside in our hearts as we reside in the world? After we recite the three refuges, we recite the three pure precepts. The first pure precept is, I vow to cease from evil. For me, it's not helpful to think of evil as some metaphysical entity or devil, some abstract concept even. Rather, evil points to the many things we human beings do that cause unnecessary suffering in the world. We might feel that it is particularly evil when it seems to be intentional. In case we need examples, the 10 grave precepts offer more specific advice on what we should try to avoid in order to cease from evil. Killing, stealing, misusing sex, lying, taking intoxicants, slander, praising oneself at others' expense, sparing the Dharma assets, harboring ill will, and abusing the three treasures. The precepts are lifelong vows that invite careful discernment, moment after moment. After all, situations don't come with labels. We have to see for ourselves what is happening in a given moment and consider whether our response honors the precepts. I do think that as we work with the precepts, they weave their way into our conscience. And if we're mindful, we can notice that subtle twinge in our gut, like a spidey sense, telling us, be careful here, you're about to be an asshole. I know one teacher who described the goal of practice as being a little bit less of an asshole. That resonates for me. Our formal practice, sitting on the cushion and paying attention, supports our work with the precepts. By helping us see when we are tempted to cause harm, often due to the what we call the three poisons of greed, aversion, and ignorance. Wanting things, hating things, and basic selfishness or self-centeredness often eclipse our awareness of how others might be affected by our actions. I mean, just look at Boston drivers. When we sit on the cushion, these self-centered impulses still arise. But instead of giving someone the finger, we might just watch our minds make up stories. Being stuck on the cushion prevents us from acting on harmful impulses for at least 25 minutes. Sitting still, rather than impulsively taking action on harmful impulses, it's like pressing a pause button, and then the impulses pass. We come to realize that we do not have to act on these impulses because they're ultimately insubstantial. Through practice, we understand why Hakuin wrote that devotion, repentance, training, the many paramitas all have their source in Zazen. The paramitas are the six perfections, and one of the paramitas can be translated as morality or discipline. The practice of morality, the practice of the precepts, is cultivated on the cushion. We learn to pause when we're deluded. And this practice helps us pause in the midst of delusion when we are off the cushion. That's why we call it practice. Let's say we're in an argument and it's escalating. Now let's add another layer of complexity and say that this person is a Sangha member. In our place of refuge, who keeps rubbing up against us like a potato in a boiling pot. Though it may be in some way cleansing if we can endure it, we may not like it. We may find ourselves about to figuratively give the finger to our fellow potato. But perhaps instead, we pause. We take a breath. Like we do on the cushion. We might notice that we are harboring ill will. We might realize that our view is not the only view. We might even find ourselves listening to the other person. And we might discover a more skillful way of sharing our feelings. For me, pausing helps break harmful cycles, at least some of the time. Sitting is how we practice choosing not to act on harmful impulses. It's ironic that the precepts, which act as guardrails for our behavior, and the practice of restricting our movements as we meditate, actually liberate us from the tyranny of impulses. As James Ford says, my first teacher, sometimes the best thing to do is sit down, shut up, and pay attention. All the precepts can be taken literally, but they can also be taken figuratively. For example, with avoiding intoxicants. In a literal sense, we just try to avoid indulging in alcohol and drugs. If we have habitually used them to escape difficult feelings, we may initially find ourselves feeling more anxious and distressed. The practice of sitting can be helpful in such times. We practice letting these feelings just be and caring for them lovingly rather than avoiding them through alcohol or escapes. We let the Sangha hold us in this practice. Yes, even that old difficult potato. In a figurative sense, intoxicants might also point to the ways we use distractions to try to avoid feeling our feelings. We might find ourselves scrolling endlessly on a phone or binge-watching endless hours of Netflix. Now, once in a while, this isn't the problem. But when these things become habits and when we realize we need them to relax or escape, our addiction actually prolongs our suffering. Indeed, our need to avoid feelings can become a dependency that controls us. We're no longer free to be as we are. To no longer indulge intoxicants is to turn toward things just as they are, including our troubled hearts, and to care for these feelings consciously so that we can heal. I'd also like to highlight how many of the precepts relate to right speech. This is because we can cause great harm with our tongues. I've given a talk on right speech. I think it's on the website. So I won't do a deep dive here. I've recently gave that talk. But the precepts encourage us not to speak falsely, not to find fault with others, not to elevate ourselves at the expense of others, not to defame the three treasures. In addition to what I said in my recent talk, I think these particular precepts offer a little kind of meta guidance in how to work with the precepts themselves. Do we hold ourselves as above others because we think we have the best understanding of the precepts? Or because we think we do a better job than others at honoring them? Do we think we are absolutely right and others are absolutely wrong? Do we use the precepts to judge other people? Thinking this way, we might say, breaks the precepts not to find fault with others and not to elevate ourselves at the expense of others. And this can escalate, of course, when we do this. Wars are fought by opposing sides who are both absolutely right. When I start criticizing others, I try to remind myself that when I point at someone else, three fingers point back at myself. In our tradition, we emphasize tending our own garden. I also don't think of the precepts as strict rules, but as bells that awaken us when we might behave unskillfully. But no single interpretation needs to be the rule in every situation, nor for every person. We each work with the precepts in the context of our own very different lives and backgrounds and changing circumstances. For one person, I mean, this is not necessarily the most relevant example to everyone in the room, but for one person, a beer on Friday night might not be a problem. For someone else, it could cause a spiral into a hell realm. When we're considering taking that drink, the bell rings, waking us up to what we are doing. We can then pay close attention to whether our choices cause more or less suffering over time. Then we can do our best to make choices that minimize suffering. But those choices may be different for each of us. A wonderful opening phrase I think we can use when discussing the precepts might be something like, "For me, what does taking refuge mean?" Well, for me, it means the precepts won't mean exactly the same thing for us all. Particularly as lay practitioners, we each make them work within our own house. If we are honest, we are also likely to realize that we can't honor the precepts perfectly. We kill plants to survive, or more significantly, perhaps, what if we have a means to kill a mass shooter? Should we? Now, we're extremely unlikely to face that situation, but it illustrates the point. Sometimes we might consciously decide to break one precept in order to fulfill another. And this is how our ethics can get muddy. For example, perhaps we're considering pointing out someone's minor ethical lapse in order to protect others from being harmed. This might seem like fault-finding, but it might also seem necessary. Or perhaps a country considers going to war to prevent a racial genocide. Sometimes the best we get in working with the precepts is a clear view of muddy water. And reasonable people might disagree about what to do. In these circumstances, all we can do, I think, is do our best. My guiding ethic is to minimize harm and to be of benefit as best I can, but I certainly don't always get it right. In fact, I don't even know a lot of the times when I've gotten it wrong. So we make mistakes. And perhaps we can be a tiny bit more aware of our mistakes and try to take responsibility. When we do cause harm, we're encouraged to atone and start again. All evil karma ever created by me since of old, on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, born of my body, mouth, and thought, I vow to atone for it all. I vow to repair my wrongs and do better in the future. I think this is at the heart of our practice. If you're anything like me, pride may sometimes get in your way. But sitting on the cushion often helps me to see more clearly, oh yeah, I was just a jerk. Then I can apologize and try to do better. So our practice might be described this way: vow, screw up, atone, vow again. If that doesn't teach us a bit of humility, I don't know what will. While the first pure precept is caution, don't worry, I don't spend this long in every one of these. While the first pure precept is cautionary regarding causing harm, the second pure precept encourages positive action. The second pure precept reads, I vow to practice good. Once again, we can be guided by the 10 grave precepts, which, like the second pure precept, can be rearticulated as positive aspirations. I vow to protect life, be generous, engage in mutually respectful intimacy, tell the truth, nourish my mind and body, speak kindly, appreciate others, share the Dharma, be forgiving, support the three treasures. The second pure precept, to practice good, encourages us to be active rather than passive. We not only cease from causing harm, but actively practice being of benefit however we can, one moment at a time. And of course, we screw that up all the time too. That one moment at a time seems important to me. The precepts encourage us to stay awake moment after moment, noticing, well, maybe we could be of service, and knowing when to hold back. This brings us to a deep synthesizing vow, a third pure precept. I vow to save all beings. Of course, all our vows are impossible in the literal sense. We cannot free or save all beings. But the vow still inspires us to be of greater benefit than we might have been otherwise. As a high school teacher, I know I can't always engage every student. But I vow to try, and this probably makes me a slightly better teacher for my students. So we vow and do our best. In the literal sense, we make the vow to save all beings. In the compassionate sense, we know we will fail. We forgive ourselves, and we keep trying. And we forgive others who aren't meeting our own expectations, knowing there but for the grace of karma go I. And in the non-dualistic sense, there are no separate beings anywhere to save. Each of us is an expression of the infinite universe and is already saved. We are already Buddhas. Game over. Still, though all beings are already saved, we should save all beings. That is our vow. Fundamentally, the 16 Bodhisattva precepts help us avoid self-centered, harmful actions and encourage beneficial actions in the service of all beings. These great vows invite heightened awareness moment after moment and help us realize how deeply interconnected we are. Our actions matter. When I received the precepts in Jukai ceremony, I cried, and I didn't even know why. The ceremony operated on a level beneath my conscious mind. It seemed like after I thought of it as having released and fulfilled all kinds of ancient karma. Receiving the precepts in a formal ceremony makes our personal vows public in a way that echoes throughout space and time. But even if you just receive the precepts in your own heart, your vows will ring like a bell across the universe. Thank you.